This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Google has teamed up with T-Mobile and gadget maker HTC to fire the first shot in the smartphone wars. This week, they unveiled their new G1 phone, ready to hit the shelves next month, take on the iPhone. It comes complete with touchscreen, email, maps, internet browsing. How much, though, is it like the iPhone? How does it stack up? Well, my next guest had the opportunity to actually play around with the G1 phone earlier this week. He did a side-by-side comparison. He's here with us today. Joshua Topolsky is the editor-in-chief of Engadget.com. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you? It's Engadget.
Engadget. What did I say?
Well, it happens. You know, you might have said N. That could be my mistake.
You've done too much radio. I guess
it's possible.
Engadget. So is it an app killer? Is it an iPhone killer, this thing?
Well, I'm not sure it's an iPhone killer. I mean, I feel like that term gets thrown around a lot. It's a good phone. It's got a lot of really interesting features. It's different than the iPhone. And I think it's going to appeal to some people who might buy an iPhone, but there's going to be a lot of people who are looking for something slightly different, and that's where it's aimed.
Mm-hmm. And what's slightly different about it?
Well, for one thing, it's built on sort of this idea of open source and openness. Google's whole, you know, their whole spiel on the phone is, we're not going to put restraints on you. You can do whatever you want with it. You can put whatever apps you want on it. And so I think that people who are looking for a little more tweakability, you know, geeks will get into it a bit more, whereas the iPhone is aimed squarely at a broad, casual, you know, more of a casual consumer market.
And they've actually, there's been a lot of people complaining this week and recently that Apple has been too strict in what it allows on its own iPhone.
Yeah, the timing is actually quite good for T-Mobile and Google and HTC, the company that makes the phone, because Apple has taken a lot of heat recently for the way they've been running their app store, you know, mm-hmm. which is where you can buy applications for the iPhone. They've been, you know, basically they've been sort of arbitrarily, mysteriously pulling applications. And, you know, they've got a really strict set of rules that they use and to judge what goes on in the store and what doesn't. And so the timing is great for T-Mobile because they're saying, look, here's something where you can do what you want. We're not going to tell you not to do it. We won't pull your app off of our app store. They have an app store called the Android Marketplace. So it's, you know, definitely there's a bit of a storm brewing in that region.
How about the keyboard? One of the things that the iPhone was revolutionary in is having that glass, no real keys on it. You can make the keyboard, the face look like anything you want it to. Is that the same here?
Well, I mean, it's a touchscreen phone. It uses a similar technology to the iPhone for its touchscreen, but it also has this flip-out physical keyboard. So you've got a lot of what the iPhone's doing in terms of the screen can be whatever you want, and it's got, you know, it's a capacitive, they call it a capacitive touch screen, which is more sensitive than the typical touch screens you see on phones. But, you know, the physical keyboard is kind of a big win in a lot of ways. A lot of people aren't comfortable with the iPhone's virtual keyboard. So, it doesn't have a virtual keyboard. You have to use the physical one.
Let's get a phone call or two. Mike from Portland, Oregon. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead.
I was wondering if Google is successful in promoting this Android platform across multiple companies, doesn't that open up the possibility of virus attack?
Yeah, if it's open source, can't more people get in and hack the system?
Well, there's certainly you're probably a little bit more at risk than with an iPhone. But, you know, we've got phones like Windows Mobile phones, for instance, and Palm phones that have been pretty much free reign. You can make whatever apps you want for them. And they haven't really been plagued with viruses or malware very much. So, I mean, I think, you know, we'll see. This is a much bigger market they're playing for than the sort of business users or the geekier users for those devices. But, you know, I think that I think they're going to be keeping a watch. It's not just going to be do as you please. I think that they're going to be keeping a very close eye on the kind of apps that people are making.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. You talked about Apple keeping its system very close to its chest, and it does that. Don't you have to be a Google user to use this phone, too?
You know, this is – I haven't gotten a confirmation on this. I've heard different people say different things. But it does – I mean, at the basic base of this, you have to use Gmail to get contacts onto the device to sync contacts, which would – I would imagine means you need to have a Gmail account. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they're – I don't think they're going to have a service where you just have your contacts separate. So I think there is – obviously, they're trying to tie in their cloud services and their webmail to the phone. So yeah, the way it looks is you're going to have a Google account to use it.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything missing, glaringly missing? Oh, how did they forget to put this in
on the
there?
G1?
Yeah.
Well, very much like Apple, they don't have any kind of video recorder. You can do pictures, but if you want to shoot a video, there's no way to do it right now, which seems very odd. They don't have a video player. There's apparently one that's available on their application store, the marketplace, but it doesn't come with one. So if you want to watch a video on it, you have to get a separate app. Right. That you need to download. You know, it doesn't have multi-touch the way the iPhone does. So when you want to zoom in on something, you actually have to use a little plus or
you
minus.
Can't squeeze it with your fingers.
There's no
like
pinching,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
There's no two-finger gestures that you use on it. So it is missing a few things, but I think it's missing far less than the iPhone was when it came out of the gate.
Mm-hmm. Do you expect it to be as big a seller as the iPhone?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, AT&T is a very dominant network here in America, and Apple, of course, is a brand to be reckoned with. This is a little more grassroots, and I think that for T-Mobile, it's going to be very successful. And I think for Google, it's going to really cement their place as a contender in smartphones and in sort of this converged area that we're moving into with devices. Will it sell as many? I mean,
who knows?
I don't know, but I would say not at a glance, probably not.
Why would a programmer want to write a program for this phone versus write one for the iPhone?
Well, I think that the main reason. Okay, so. If you write an application for the iPhone,
right.
You can't write a web browser. You can't make your own web browser, your own email application. There's very restrictive limitations put on developers for the iPhone. You can do certain things. You can't do other things. Apple's sort of vague about it, but they don't want you competing with their products that are on the, you know, their apps that are on the phone. Whereas with Android, you can do whatever you want. You want a browser, an email client. You can go ahead and do it. So if you're going to invest a lot of time and money in something, you know, you sort of have to – with Apple, you have to hope that they'll approve the application, whereas with the G1 and Android, it'll go out to the marketplace.
The fact that Google has jumped in here, is that sort of heading off the path somebody like Microsoft that might want to jump in with their own iPhone?
Well, I mean, Microsoft has a big place in the market with Windows Mobile. So I'm sure what they're looking at is advancing that into the next stage, something that's probably, you know, more touch, more flashy. I'm not sure that I don't think this precludes the possibility of something like a Zune phone or some sort of Microsoft sort of more consumer-oriented phone. But it certainly is, you know, Google entering this market is going to be added, you know, big added competition for those guys.
Yeah, they are an 800-pound gorilla now. Right?
Yeah, I mean, they're not fooling around. I mean, Google is a very serious contender. I mean, they own so much of what goes on online, you know, that for them to step into the phone OS or device OS area is a pretty big deal.
Now, there are a lot of early adapters. You probably may be one of them. I got to have that first one that's out there.
It's possible. That is possible.
Well, look what happened to a lot of people who bought the first iPhone, and they paid a lot of money for it. And then just a few months later, the second version came out, a couple of $100 less or more.
Yeah. Well, it was about a year later. But they did reduce the
burned.
Price.
They felt they got burned by being an early adapter. Might the same thing be happening here? Should you wait? You know?
The price of entry is way lower for this. If you're signing a new contract or a T-Mobile customer renewing your contract, it's $179, which is not a huge investment for a lot of phone buyers right now. So it's not that $600, you know, what was it, $599
right.
for the iPhone when it came out, which is astronomical now, looking at what they're charging at this $199 that they're charging now.
Mm-hmm. And the service plan, is it basically the same?
It's actually, I mean, in terms of what you get, I think it's a little bit more economical. They offer a $25 plan, which is unlimited data and 400 text messages, and then they have a $35 plan, which is unlimited everything, basically. Apple and AT&T, it's a little bit more expensive.
What about the bandwidth, the wide channel? fast downloads. Do they have
It's a 3G. It's a 3G device, but T-Mobile's 3G network, which is different than AT&T's, is not nearly as widespread as AT&T's is. They don't have as many areas of coverage. So, you know, there's a trade-off there. Then again, AT&T's can be very spotty. So
yeah, they also talked about that there was a cap on this early on the service.
You know, the day of the announcement, there was this kind of small text saying, we're going to cap you at a gig a month. And if you go beyond 1 gig of data a month, we're going to slow your downloads. But they actually, you know, really responded to we saw a big outcry on our site. Of users very upset about it. And I think they really responded to it, and they've actually taken that off of the documentation now. So
if you're starting out with your first smartphone and you're choosing between an iPhone and this new phone, who's this for? Who's it not for?
Well, you know, there's a lot of factors.
Yeah, I mean, if you just, you know, I don't know how to use any electronic device. You're like, you're the person that can't fix the 12 on the clock.
Yeah, you should probably get an iPhone in that case, because it's a much more controlled environment. It's a slicker environment, and it's more geared towards you're not going to run off the beaten path. You know, you're staying on what Apple has sort of set up for you.
And when you plug it in, it goes right to iTunes.
Yeah, it's all
familiar
integrated.
Interface.
Exactly.
Is this phone also integrated into something?
No, this is only – well, it's integrated into Gmail and into Google services. So you get tight integration with – if you're a Gmail user, and a lot of people are now. But in terms of you're an Apple user and you've got all your contacts and the Apple address book and, you know,
calendar.
Your email accounts, calendar – it's not going to sync with those. And so for a lot of users, that's going to be – same with Windows. It's not going to sync with your Outlook. So that's kind of a roadblock, I think, for a lot of users, especially entry-level users who just want something easy.
So you'd have to migrate all of those to the equivalent Google apps online.
Essentially, you'd have to put your contacts and your calendar data into Gmail or Google.
And you press a button and it syncs just like it would.
It actually syncs over the air, so it syncs continuously. Huh. If you change your contacts in your Gmail, it will push that to the phone and vice versa.
I'm doing that on my iPhone with my
Gmail.
Yeah,
right. No, it's very similar.
Same thing.
Very similar.
Well, thanks, Josh. Thank you for taking time to be with us. Josh Topolsky is editor-in-chief of Engadget,
engadget.com.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a short break, switch gears, and when we come back, we're going to talk with Carl Gerassi. He's here to talk about his new play, Taboos, which talks about, maybe you don't need people to have children or something like that. Stay with us. We'll explain what it is when we come back. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. My next guest is one of the fathers of the birth control pill, but he has turned away from the chemistry lab, we did that many years ago, to pen plays for the theater. And his most recent is called Taboos, and is playing for the next 3 weeks here in New York. And the play tells the story of two couples trying to become parents through artificial means. One is a lesbian couple, the other an infertile Christian husband and wife, and the play raises some really interesting and complicated questions about reproduction when sex and children no longer go hand in hand. So what does it mean to be a parent in the modern world of birth control, infertility drugs, test tube babies, when we all can interchange our sperm and egg and then raise children with surrogate parents, all kinds of issues, very interesting issues. Carl Gerassi is the playwright behind Taboos and Professor Emeritus at the Department of Chemistry at Stanford University. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks very much.
Good to have you back. What's the catalyst for this play?
well, that's my preoccupation during the last probably 20 years when I started moving from a laboratory to becoming an author, first of novels and then of plays. I really first started with the issue of reproduction. What is happening in this world? The increasing separation of sex and reproduction. Sex as usual in usual places. Reproduction more and more under the microscope, under other assisted conditions. Mm-hmm. And the implication that it has, not so much just the scientific ones, but really the societal ones. And that includes everything from women's rights and the power position of men and women, the power relation of women and women in sex and reproduction, all the way to religion. Incidentally, I want to make one correction. you introduced me by saying, not introduced the play, by saying a lesbian couple and a Christian couple. A Christian is not really correct. It is a fundamentalist couple, because it wouldn't make any difference whether they're Christian or Jewish or Muslim or anything else. But I wanted to say fundamentalist. Mm-hmm. And fundamentalist doesn't have to be fundamentalist Christian, although in this case it is. Mm-hmm. Because I think that is another issue that I find is necessary to address, namely people who have very preconceived notions about what is proper and improper in sex and reproduction, and yet they themselves frequently violate it, which to me is a form of hypocrisy to which we should call attention, particularly in this politically charged climate right now.
Mm-hmm. Do you write these plays because you think these are dialogues that scientists should be having, but they don't speak out enough about them?
Well, that is true also of fiction, mm-hmm. the science fiction that I wrote first. I've written 5 such novels and now about 8 plays. But that's the fundamental point. Scientists, I'm talking about active research scientists, don't spend the time of talking to the public for very obvious reasons. Not only don't they think they have the time, but they get no brownie points for it by their professional peers. And really, professional recognition in science depends entirely, absolutely entirely on your peers and not on the general public. So you really don't get any brownie points for that. And the people that are willing to do this, people like me, basically doing this when they are, emeriti or close to the end of their active professional career, which is extremely unfortunate. But I think we scientists have to talk to the public, and I am particularly interested in doing it in a dialogic format rather than just giving popular lectures or writing popular articles, because dialogue, really the most human form of intercourse, you might say, which was used in literature from the Greeks all the way through Galileo and to the Renaissance, is not used as a literary genre now, except in plays. Mm-hmm. Now, the plays that I'm writing are intellectual plays. They are, I hope, also amusing, and there were a lot of laughs in the performance I saw right now of Taboos. But, you know, any play is only seen for a short while, and I really feel very strongly that plays can also be read as books, certain plays. Plays of Tom Stoppard, for instance, just to give an example, mm-hmm. are wonderful literature. And just to call them plays is in a way demeaning them or limiting their exposure. And I feel very strongly about this. And this is why I'm delighted that actually this play was just published in book form just a couple of weeks ago by the University of Wisconsin Press under the excellent title, Sex in an Age of Technological Reproduction. And that's really the theme that I'm addressing.
Yeah, it is. The difference between having children just sexually reproducing and being parents, too.
Yeah, but that is a key point. Again, in the introduction, you asked the question, well, can we now have children, you know, without people? You're only talking about the reproduction, the actual fertilization in the next 9 months. Well, the 9 months, even that is done within the woman. But the fertilization, but what I want to focus on, the really important thing is we shouldn't always talk about how to become parents in a biological sense, but how we behave as true parents. In other words, fathers who all just always are preoccupied about genetic fatherhood, you know, the man's family name or the family blood, things like this, are inconsequential compared to the role that you're playing as a parenting father. And people who think that this impending separation of sex and reproduction will destroy or affect the nuclear family are totally wrong, in my opinion. Because if you, in fact, resort to more and more to assisted reproductive techniques for various reasons, and we can try and address them, not just infertile people, but fertile people, but you only do this once or twice in your lifetime, because in Europe, the average-sized family is now 1.5 children. In the United States, it's something like 2.1. So people have very few children. So the important thing is, what do they then do with the children? How do they behave toward the children? And that a wanted child, because any child produced by assisted reproduction is a wanted child, not an inadvertent one, not an accidental pregnancy, is a cement for a functioning family. And since both parents then want to have a child, I think they both are going to pay more attention to the parenting aspects of it, which I think makes it a much better and more meaningful nuclear family than just one which is a family in name only and where the mother plays most of the functions.
1-800-989-8255. Talking with Carl Gerassi, playwright, writer, fiction, nonfiction, in particular his new play, Taboos, which is running here in New York. It's been running, we're running for about 3 weeks. Let's see if we can get a call in. Elaine in Fort Myers. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. I just wanted to comment that this, it is a situation that happens only at reproduction, and yet it does go on. I conceived my son almost, he's going to be 10 next month, by artificial insemination. And it's funny because I was talking with a colleague today. He just joined Cub Scouts. And so this weekend we're going on our first outing, and yet again I will be faced with relative strangers who almost look at our family with pity until they understand the situation. It's like we were never abandoned. Nobody left us. We're good to go. We're fine. This is our family. It's been like this for a long time, and we're just fine with it. And it's kind of interesting that it is an ongoing decision. It's an ongoing decision about this decision and about this type of family.
You're a single mom.
I am, yeah. By choice.
Yeah. Carl, any comment?
No, I don't have any comment because, in fact, I write exactly in one of my novels, my third novel, Menachem Seed, I'm writing exactly about this kid, a professional woman who decides to have a child, did not find the right man or didn't even want one, and is prepared to go through committed single motherhood. It is better to have two parents, but it is really particularly important to have one loving parent. Many people are born under conditions, many babies are born or children are born under conditions where they were totally unwanted. Remember, out of all pregnancies that occur in the world, about 50% are unexpected, and 25% of them are unwanted. And that results, that's the reason why we have nearly 50 million abortions each year. So it is much, much better to have one loving parent than to have two lousy ones. And I think lots of people have these.
Okay, Elaine, thanks. Thanks for calling. 1-800-989-8255. I find that your plays could be great educational tools. Do you find that schools are able to use them, or are your topics so controversial these days and not politically correct enough for a lot of schools that they shun them?
Well, forget about political correctness, but your question is a key question. Now, this play, Taboos, is written for the commercial theater and involves, you know, theater production and so on. I've written at the same time a play just called ICSI, ICSI, and that is the technique that we're referring to, intercytoplasmic sperm injection, or the injection of a single sperm into an egg, which is one of the key methods that is being used, and that's having an enormous enormous ethical and practical and reproductive consequences. And that play, which is a pedagogic wordplay, just for two voices, and you just need to read them, you need no staging and so on, with audiovisual materials, also included in that same book with which came out in Taboos. And this has now been used in Europe, and actually also in Taiwan, because it was translated into German, before hundreds and hundreds of high school students that I saw, but I also saw it at two medical congresses. I saw it at the Royal Academy of Medicine in England. BBC Radio 3 broadcast it, where I played one of the roles, and the interviewer, Vivian Perry, a woman, Ira Flato, in London, the other role. We didn't tell the people, it was before a live BBC audience, that in fact it was a pedagogic play that I had written, because it's in the form of a TV interview between a woman green moderator, very critical moderator, and a scientist discussing these particular fields, subjects, so you get the pros and cons all the time. You don't just get one view. That's a very important thing, and I don't give them any answers. I only raise questions. And when we did this on the BBC, people had not realized that, in fact, we were doing a play of mine. They thought it was a real interview because it was before a live audience, and then they announced that, in fact, it was a play, and everyone was rather amused by this. So I have very important pedagogic motives, and that is the reason why this paperback, which I happen to clutch in my hand, which is called Sex in the Nature of Technological Reproduction, contains both plays. It contains the play Taboos, it contains the pedagogic wordplay ICSI, which is only 45 minutes long, so it fits into classroom, I think so, and it contains a CD with all the audiovisuals. It even shows a DVD of the actual ICSI injection, how you see the injection of a single sperm into an egg, which is very dramatic. There's nothing question of political correctness. There are no four-letter words in there. If people are embarrassed to look at this, then I think they fail entirely in sex education in schools, but entirely.
Do you think that scientists can learn something from your place?
I beg pardon?
Do you think that scientists, too, could learn things from your place?
I have no question whatsoever. I've done this better. First of all, if I ask a group of chemists, just tell me what is ICSI. Well, you know, 9 out of 10 haven't got the foggiest idea. And after all, most scientists, other than reproductive biologists or biologists, are really not any better informed about reproduction and the complicated social consequences than any other person. Mm. I mean, we are just all citizens. And I think this is not written down to an audience. It's written to a general audience. As I told you, it was done before the Royal Academy of Medicine, where the average audience was 60, and these were the hotshots of British medicine. And they were as taken and engaged by this as I saw it with high school students. Now, when I talk high school students, I basically mean juniors and seniors. It's not that younger ones can understand it, but I think the language is perhaps a little bit more sophisticated because I really don't like to talk down to people.
I'm talking with Carl Gerasi, author of the new play Taboos, Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. Let's see if we can get another phone call in before we run out of time. Michelle in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, if you shut your radio off.
Yes. Hold on. But I had a question. I agreed to be an egg donor for a friend of mine, and the process went quite well, and so I did it again, but for someone that I didn't know. But it's just kind of a strange reality to me that when I go out in public, I'm not particularly fond of having children myself, but children who are of that same age range of around the period that I would have donated could technically be mine, and that's just a strange reality for me to kind of think about, and I wondered if you guys could comment on.
I mean, as you were out in the street, you think, gee, this could be my kid.
Yeah, especially if it's, some screaming child. I'm like, well, I need to be nice because you never know.
Interesting, Carl.
I don't understand. Are you asking this question as an egg donor, or are you asking this in the case of a man as a sperm donor?
She's an egg donor.
Yeah.
Well, I think, first of all, this is the key question in Taboos, namely even the generosity, because it is very easy for a man to be a sperm donor. You know, he just masturbates. For a woman, it is much more complex, and there are many more issues involved in this. And I have to say I enormously admire women who are generous enough to do this, because they are believing in, first of all, helping parents who cannot have children, particularly women, and who feel very strongly that they do not want to adopt but want to go through the intimate birthing process, even though it's not their own genetic child. And I think I can only commend the caller. I can only say I wish you would see my play, because you'll see there is the issue, the discussion. It's in this case a conflict between a surrogate egg donor who also is a mother at the same time, because she donates one of her eggs to one woman, but the other one she does herself. And then the question is, who has, mother's rights to which child? This becomes very complex. You seem to have done this in a simpler, more straightforward way, so maybe you wouldn't appear in my play, but I like what you said.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, Michelle, have a good weekend. 1-800-989-8255. And you don't resolve you don't answer the things.
I feel strongly, Ira, that I shouldn't, because then I become a preacher. I'm a scientist, and I'm a socially responsible person. I want to raise these crucial questions. I think this is the overpowering issue, the direction in which sex and reproduction go in this century. I want to show the facts, not just the scientific facts, which make these things possible, but the manner, the good and bad manner, because sometimes we use it very inappropriately, that these things are being used for. But in the end, they have to be private decisions by an individual. So I want to present them with the facts, and then I would then like to debate this. And in my plays, I want to provoke them. And I think it would be inappropriate for them to tell what Carl Gerasi thinks, because what I think is really only the opinion of one man. And so what? Why should that apply to others? This is why I really believe that sex and reproduction really cannot be legislated. Even many religions fail this. I mean, the best example is that the highest proportion of illegal abortions in the world right now are in all Catholic Latin American countries, or that Italy and Spain, you know, two all Catholic countries, have the lowest birth rates in Europe. And, of course, how do they do this? Clearly not by abstaining, but by using contraception. So you see here people are violating religious beliefs because their beliefs and feelings about sex and reproduction are even stronger. And I think we have to accept that, but we should be willing to debate them and not convince other people the correctness of our opinion, but accept the fact that there have to be compromises. These are not black and white issues. They're inherently gray ones, and you're only going to get gray answers.
Carl, I wish you great success and with your play, Taboos, in New York. Hopefully it'll get around the country so other people can see it there, too, or read it online now, as you say they can.
Well, they can read Sex in an Age of Technological Hypodactyl,
right,
the book.
Carl Gerassi, stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. And as we talk about problems on Wall Street, the economy, oh, global warming, you name it, traffic this weekend, I've got something else for you to perhaps worry about. And that is something unusual going on with the solar wind. The latest measurements of the solar wind by the Ulysses space probe, it's in polar orbit around the sun, indicates that the million-mile-an-hour plasma emanating from the sun, called the solar wind, is weaker. It's weaker than they've seen it since the beginning of the space age, like 50 years or so like that. And, of course, that's, as I say, 50 years and a lifetime of what? A 5-billion-year-old sun? So what? Maybe it's just an anomaly. Might the softer wind, though, have an impact on here on Earth? Or maybe astronauts heading towards International Space Station? Some of the answers we hope to get from our next guest, David McComas. David McComas is a principal investigator for the Ulysses Solar Wind Observation. It's over the poles, and it's called SWOOPS. It's a big experiment, the SWOOPS experiment. He's also senior executive director of the Space Science and Engineering Division at Southwest Research Institute in San Antonio, Texas. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Ira.
Good afternoon, Dr. McComas. Should we be worried about
this? Well, I don't think we should be worried. It's very interesting what's happening with the sun and the solar wind. But I don't think it portends any particular crisis, at least in the near future.
Give us an idea of exactly what the solar wind is first.
Okay, so the solar wind is the outer atmosphere of our sun expanding out into space. When you see, for example, an eclipse or a photo of an eclipse where the bright surface of the sun is blocked out, you can see around the outside of that a dimmer region, which we call the corona. The corona is basically the atmosphere of the sun, and at the outer boundaries of the corona, material is constantly evaporating out into space, all directions, all the time. It forms an ionized gas that a scientist called plasmas, an ionized gas, which just means the electrons and ions are separated from each other, and it flows out at about 1,000,000 miles per hour in all directions all the time from the sun.
Mm-hmm. And it's just a normal thing we've known about for billions. I mean, it's happening for billions of years, right?
It's been happening for billions of years.
And we discovered it many years ago.
It was first inferred from observations of comet tails in the, I think, the 1950s, but it wasn't directly measured until the very early 1960s.
Does it have any protective effect?
So the solar wind extends out, blowing out all these directions at 1,000,000 miles an hour, and it basically inflates a bubble in space. And that bubble is something that we call the heliosphere, helios from the Greek for sun, and sphere just the region of influence. So the heliosphere is the region of influence of our sun. And basically this expanding solar wind blows this bubble and pushes out the rest of the galaxy. And out at a very great distance, about 3 times farther than the farthest planet, is the edge of this bubble, and beyond that is the local part of the galaxy. The local part of the galaxy is filled with radiation that we call galactic cosmic rays or galactic cosmic radiation, and basically this protective bubble formed by the solar wind excludes the vast majority of those galactic cosmic rays. So yes, it does protect the inner solar system quite a bit from the high energy radiation outside in the galaxy.
So does that mean if we have a weaker solar wind, more of those potentially harmful rays, when I say that? what might be heading in our direction?
That's true. As the solar wind weakens, it's sort of like a tire that's being inflated or a balloon. If there's less pressure on the inside, the pressure on the outside makes it a smaller, makes the heliosphere smaller and allows some more of those cosmic rays to make their way into the inner heliosphere, to the planets and to the region of space that we care the most about.
But we have our own Earth's magnetic field that might protect us.
Right. So we on Earth are actually protected two more ways. We have our own magnetic field, which forms something we call a magnetosphere around the Earth, the region of influence that the Earth's magnetic field dominates. And inside of that, we have our own atmosphere, and the galactic cosmic rays are largely stopped in the Earth's atmosphere. So here on Earth, we don't really have a problem with galactic cosmic rays. But if we were, for example, astronauts on our way to Mars, we wouldn't have any of those protections. And the trip, for example, to Mars takes many months. And so in that sort of environment, it is a concern just exactly how intense the galactic cosmic radiation making its way into the inner heliosphere actually is.
So it wouldn't affect astronauts in the space shuttle or the space station?
So they're protected by the Earth's magnetic field and magnetosphere. They're not protected by the atmosphere, but they're still very well protected by the magnetic field of the Earth in low Earth orbit where the space station is.
Now, the instruments on Ulysses, have they been sending back information over the years? And do you see a gradual drop in the wind, or was this something that sort of spiked?
Yeah, so first maybe I should just tell you a little tiny bit about Ulysses. It's an amazing mission. It's the only mission that humanity has ever sent out of the plane of the planets. Basically, all the planets orbit around the sun pretty much in a plane, which we call the ecliptic plane, the equatorial plane of the sun. Ulysses was launched in October 1990 by a joint team. It's a European Space Agency and NASA joint mission, tremendous international mission. Launched in October 1990, flew out to Jupiter and used the intense gravity of Jupiter to sling it out of this equatorial plane and go over the poles of the sun. And what's really important about our observations from Ulysses is it doesn't just tell us about the solar wind here locally, but it tells us about the solar wind at all latitudes. So with Ulysses, we've been able to understand this expanding solar wind as a three-dimensional structure and not just down in the equatorial plane. So we've been making solar wind measurements from Ulysses for 18 years now. And we've been going over in this polar orbit for the last 16 years, since February 1992. So what we've observed over those 16 years is pretty much a slow and steady decline. There are smaller scale ups and downs to it, but on average, sort of a continuing decrease over those 15 or 16 years. And that's been through the previous minimum of the sunspot and solar activity cycle, through the maximum, the last maximum of the solar activity cycle, and now through the current minimum of the solar activity cycle. So even as the sun's output has varied and solar activity has come and gone, the overall pressure, the overall energy being put out by the sun into the form of solar wind has dropped nearly 25%.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a big change.
No, and no theories about why.
Well, I think we understand, or some of us think we understand at least, that it's associated with less magnetic flux coming up from the inside of the sun and coming up into the solar atmosphere. Many of us believe that that's ultimately what provides the energy source that drives the solar wind. But as to why the sun's dynamo would be putting less magnetic flux into the corona, I certainly don't know, and I don't know anybody that probably does.
Let's see what our listeners have to say. 1-800-989-8255. Mark in St. Paul. Hi, Mark.
St. Paul.
Hi there. Go ahead.
I have a bit of an interest. My hobby, amateur radio, we play around with the ionosphere quite a bit, and that's reliant on the solar wind. And if you look at the American Radio Relay, they've been monitoring, and we've got almost no sunspot activity for a number of months. The question I'm kind of wondering, a while back I came across some NASA articles about the fact that the solar wind has been very quiet, and there's one scientist predicting sort of a 50-year cycle of sorts. I was wondering if there's any knowledge about that or prediction about that, and also has any relation to the solar activity and our climate aspect of the global warming in some regards.
Good questions.
Yeah, so let me take the first part of that question. It's been a tremendously quiet solar minimum the last several years, very few sunspots, very quiet conditions. quiet conditions in the ionosphere, obviously, you know, and the effects on your radio interest. Mm-hmm. The thing that's interesting about the drop in pressure of the solar wind is it extended not just in the solar minimum phase, but actually through the previous solar maximum. So while we see the output of solar wind, the pressure of the solar wind, go up and down somewhat over the solar cycle, the larger effect we've been seeing is sort of a decrease even across the solar cycle from max to min. And so it's something going on in the sun that's changing on a longer time scale than just this 11-year cycle.
Spooky, Mark, huh? Okay, thanks for calling. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. So if you had been able to observe it for longer than 50 years or 100 years, do you think you could pick up a trend or a cycle back and forth in this?
Yeah, so that's a great question, which, of course, we can't answer because we don't have the data. The sun itself has changed a lot over the centuries and the millennia. We know that there have been times when solar activity was very, very low, the Maunder minimum several hundred years ago, when the even solar maxima had very small numbers of sunspots and that sort of thing. It was probably a case that the solar wind was weaker then, but it wasn't being measured, so there's really no way to know for sure. It is the case, of course, that all of the solar wind and all of the energy of the solar wind is driven by the sun, so if the sun is putting out less power into the corona, that will manifest itself as less energy in the solar wind.
Now, we're used to seeing the energy from the sun being in visible sunlight. It heats us up. We see it every day. Where does the solar wind come from?
So, of course, the vast majority of the energy of the sun is actually invisible light, which heats the Earth and, mm-hmm. and all the things that we're used to. The energy of the solar wind probably comes from this magnetic field, which is produced in the dynamo down inside the sun.
Now, the dynamo is this fusion reaction going
on? No, the dynamo is the motion in a conducting material. In this case, it's a plasma, mm-hmm. this ionized gas. And when you have motion in this conducting gas, you basically can generate magnetic fields mm-hmm. by the motion and the charged particles.
The sun is a big ball of gas.
It's a big ball of gas, and there are motions inside of it mm-hmm. Which generate magnetic fields. And, interestingly, the solar cycle that we see, the direction of the sun's magnetic field flips over every 11 years. And so for 11 years it points south, and for 11 years it points north and back and forth. So there's something very interesting going on inside the sun generating this dynamo. Mm. And as that magnetic field is generated, some of it leaks out and is emitted out into open magnetic field in the corona, which then can be converted into power in the solar wind.
Mm-hmm. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Talking with David McComas, principal investigator for the SWOOPS experiment, talking about the sun. And I guess what you're saying is that there's less we know about the sun than we thought we did.
Yeah, that, of course, is one of the really interesting things about science. When you start to get data and observations and start to understand things better, almost always you find that the problems are harder and deeper than you thought when you started. And you work your way down through them and eventually come to a good understanding. But we're certainly not there yet as far as the sun goes or the solar wind.
Okay, what about the future? Can you get a new probe that might answer some of those questions?
So there are new probes going up every few years that study different sorts of things. As far as the three-dimensional structure of the solar wind and the heliosphere goes, Ulysses has really been unique. And right now, while there are things that we scientists talk about as possible replacements someday, there's nothing really planned to go into a similar orbit over the poles of the sun. On the other hand, in less than a month, right now scheduled for October 19th, there's going to be a new space probe launched by NASA called the Interstellar Boundary Explorer, or IBEX for short, which instead of going and traveling out to this interstellar boundary is actually able to make images of the interstellar boundary from the inside looking out. And it will be the first time that we'll be able to actually see this interaction between the solar wind and the galaxy, and we'll be able to see that looking all directions in space from an Earth-orbiting satellite.
That's about where Voyager is now.
The right. Voyagers are actually out in this region, this interaction region, close to the boundary, the edge of the heliosphere, just inside the edge of the heliosphere. And so they're making really great measurements, both Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. But as we were just talking about with the sun, actually the biggest thing we've learned from the Voyager 1 and 2 observations is we didn't understand it nearly as well as we thought we did. We've mostly taken data which have, you know, caused great surprises and mysteries, you know, things we thought we understood, all of a sudden we realized, boy, it doesn't work like we thought. And so this combination of having the two Voyager spacecraft out there simultaneously with the IBEX observations looking all directions and getting sort of the global interaction will be just a tremendous boon for really understanding this global interaction between our sun and the galaxy for the very first time.
So tonight at dinner, when people talk about this sun and the experiment, you can actually say there is something new under the sun.
Yes, there is.
This time, and it talks about how when you think you know everything, there's always that other rock, something under the rock. That's when you turn it over, it surprises you.
Absolutely.
And the IBEX will be launched in October.
In October.
And when does it go into orbit and start working?
It takes us about 5 weeks to get it up into its final orbit and get the instruments turned on. And then it takes 6 months to make the first all-sky image because we actually use the motion of the Earth around the sun to make the measurements in all the different directions. We've actually put a little video up on your Science Friday website if people are interested in the IBEX mission that they can see how we form the images and that sort of thing.
Yeah, go to sciencefriday.com, and that's our second video sort of pick of the week this week. And you'll be making a three-dimensional image.
Right. We'll be making an image from the inside looking out covering all, you know, all directions in the sky. So it'll be a complete sky coverage.
Will we be able to look at that image ourselves and move it around, you know, like a virtual reality image?
We haven't gotten there yet, but I wouldn't be surprised.
We'd be happy to put that on our site.
well, invite me back when we have the first all-sky image, and we'll see
all
if
right.
we can do that.
All right, Dr. McComas, consider that an invitation.
Okay.
Good luck to you. Good luck on your launch in October.
Thanks so much, Ira.
David McComas is principal investigator for the Ulysses Solar Wind Observations Over the Poles of the Sun experiment. Swoops to you, a lot easier to say. He's also Senior Executive Director of the Space Science and Engineering Division at Southwest Research Institute in San Antonio, one of our favorite cities, Texas. That's about all the time we have for today. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarian Kim Oleski, and we invite you to surf over to our website if you want to see some of those pictures of the IBEX and also our Science Friday pick of the week, which is those chili peppers. See the chili farm that Flora has up there? Sometimes it gets overloaded, so be patient with everybody wanting to see it at the same time. You can also download of our blogs and our podcasts and share with us things you'd like to see on Science Friday and leave us some email over there. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.